I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. As of this morning, there are almost 400,000 reported cases of people in the United States who have been infected with the novel coronavirus and nearly 13,000 who have died from COVID-19. Hospitals and the staff who work there are on the front lines of the pandemic, in many cases putting their lives on the line to treat their COVID patients because they don't have enough personal protective equipment. Adding to the stress, worries that there will be not enough life-saving equipment, including ventilators, to meet the needs of their patients. We asked Dr. Megan Lane Fall to join us. She's an associate professor of anesthesiology and critical care at the University of Pennsylvania, also director of a new ICU being built to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. And Dr. Lane Fall, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. What is life like in the ICU these days?
It's chaotic. Let's say that. We have a tremendous team of people who have pulled together to take care of these patients, and we all have a tremendous sense of purpose, but there's still a lot of energy in figuring out how to do right by these patients.
In what way?
Well, we're trying to figure out, this is a new clinical situation that we're dealing with, this condition, this disease. We know a lot from China, we know a lot from Italy, but we're still learning how to best take care of patients who are very sick, who need a lot of sedation to be able to ventilate them, to get oxygen into them, and we're still learning how to take care of them in a way that can get them through and actually get them home. So it's still learning, and we don't have a lot of evidence to lean on at this point.
How many COVID patients do you have in the ICU?
So I haven't checked the numbers this morning. It's enough to fill at least a couple of ICUs. So wow. It's a significant number. And I was on service last week and took care of a number of COVID patients myself. So it's enough to keep us busy.
I've read a number of reports of people who's recovered from the coronavirus, but their descriptions of what the symptoms were like and particularly what breathing was like under this virus. And it, to be perfectly honest with you, it sounded completely frightening. Help us understand what these patients need, especially in the ICU, clearly in critical need of care.
Well, we're learning that there are a number of ways that people can manifest COVID-19. So the vast majority of people are going to be fine. They have either no symptoms or mild symptoms, and they never see me, which is good.
Right.
There are a proportion of people who do end up having trouble breathing. Sometimes they have chest pain. Sometimes they have difficulty taking a deep breath. Sometimes it feels like they're breathing through water. And sometimes they are, in a manner of speaking, breathing through water. For the folks that get to me, they have trouble taking a deep breath and getting enough oxygen in. So they're breathing very fast, but they're not able to take big breaths, and the oxygen levels that they're able to sustain on their own are too low to be safe. So we have to help them out.
And helping them out with ventilators, correct?
That is true for some of them. For probably about half to two-thirds of the folks that I see who end up in the ICU, we're going to need a ventilator. That number is a moving target, and it's based a little bit on what we're seeing and what we've seen in China and Italy and Seattle, which got there. You know, it was one of the first U.S. sites to get patients with this disease. But a lot of them do need a ventilator to be able to sustain those oxygen levels.
Is that because the virus is so kind of deep in the lungs?
You know, I think it has less to do with where the virus is and more to do with a person's ability to maintain their own work of breathing. So as you think about taking a deep breath in, you're using your chest wall muscles, you're using your abdominal muscles, and when you're healthy, you can do that well. But when you're sick, when your lungs get bogged down with fluid, that gets harder and harder to do. So some of it is more to do with just the work of breathing. And some people are able to do that on their own. And then some people they need some help in order to be able to recover.
What is it like to put someone on a ventilator? What do you do?
It's an interesting transition. So sometimes people come in and they're not breathing very well in the emergency department. It's very clear that they need a breathing tube and to be put on a ventilator. But for some of the folks I see, we admit them to the hospital and they're on just sort of that regular oxygen. We call it nasal cannula, the one that goes in your nose. Right. And they do all right for a while. And then over a course of days, they have more trouble breathing. And it's really interesting with those folks because we have to have a discussion with them about well, you're not breathing very well, your oxygen levels are too low, it's looking like we're going to need to put you on a breathing machine. And having the discussion with them is, it's tense because, I think at that point they realize that they need help and they want the help, but they also realize that that means they're going into the ICU and that there's a chance they might not come out of it. So for some of them, if they're able to, we'll have them call their families to say hello, hopefully not goodbye, but to at least talk to them before they go on that breathing machine, because when they do, they're usually on it for a week or two or sometimes more.
And obviously their families cannot come and visit them, which is why they need to talk to them first.
Yeah, we're still struggling with how to maintain good family communication, and we have good protocols now, and we talk to families multiple times per day. We give them a call. We give them an update. We're sometimes able to FaceTime or do some sort of video chatting, but we can't just for safety reasons have families come into the hospital.
Do you have to sedate someone then to put them on a ventilator?
We do. We have to sedate them very, very deeply. We don't always have to sedate people who are on ventilators. So for people who have other kinds of illnesses, we're often able to keep them lightly sedated or even completely awake and be on the breathing machine. But this particular disease, if we don't sedate people, then they fight the ventilator and their oxygen levels go even lower. So for most of the patients that end up on a ventilator, they're very, very deeply sedated.
Why do they have to fight you? Is there something about putting a ventilator in for this particular disease that's particularly painful or uncomfortable?
It's not that it's painful. It's part of it is the way that we do mechanical ventilation for these patients. We try to give them very small breaths. We call it low tidal volume ventilation. And that's not a normal way to breathe. So if you think about when you can't catch your breath, you're gonna stop and you're going to take a nice, big, deep breath. If we do that with the ventilator, we can actually cause more lung injury. And so when people have severe lung disease, we give them tiny, tiny little breaths. We give them a lot of them. But because that's not a natural way to breathe, your natural tendency is to fight that. So you cough and you buck and you're essentially just having a tug of war with the ventilator, and that uses more oxygen. So you actually do more poorly. So in order to ventilate you in a way that helps you get better, we have to deeply sedate so that we can do this sort of unnatural way of breathing.
And how do you monitor, as you said, someone could be on a ventilator for a week or two. How do you monitor their care, how they're doing?
We do all the things that we normally do in terms of looking at them, looking to see if they look comfortable. We follow their heart rate, their blood pressure, their oxygen levels. We're in there a lot. Our nurses are certainly at the front lines, and they're the ones that have probably the most hands-on time with our patients. But we're all assessing them to make sure that they're progressing according to the way that we'd like them to get them closer to getting better. But this particular disease, it's a long haul. The ICU lengths to stay for these patients, they're much longer than usual.
And I'm assuming on ventilators longer than other patients that would need a ventilator?
Absolutely. So it depends on what brings you into the ICU, what puts you on the ventilator. But I'm used to seeing a patient on the ventilator for maybe a couple of days to a week. If you're really, really sick, maybe a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. But these patients, it's shift everything, sort of add a week to all of those times. It takes an extraordinary amount of time to wean them off, which is one of the reasons that we're so concerned with our supply of ventilators and ICU beds, because they come into the hospital and they just stay.
Let me read an email from Pamela who said, I've read that most COVID-19 patients who go on ventilators don't survive anyway. Wondering, do ventilators really help? Do we know enough to be able to answer that question?
It's a fair question. I don't think we know at this point. I think when you look across the world and you look in different centers, you see very different ranges in terms of the survival once you're on a ventilator. Certainly your risk of not surviving that goes up when you're on a ventilator, but we still believe that we can save the majority of the people that we put on ventilators. That's why we think this is a worthwhile effort.
The big question, of course, and we're sort of waiting to see how, the apex of this pandemic is, do you have enough ventilators today, and do you have enough for what you think the future might bring?
So we definitely have enough ventilators today. I'm happy to be able to say that.
That's good.
I think, yes, it's very good. It's very good. Moving forward, I guess the question depends on the models that are projecting the number of patients. And that's really what we're concerned about And why I wrote the op-ed that I wrote in the Philadelphia Inquirer, because if you look at the most dire projections around the country, we don't have enough ventilators. And so that's why we're looking at sort of atypical strategies of dealing with these. So it's finding ventilators wherever we can. It's looking at veterinary schools that maybe they have ventilators they're not using. It's looking for home ventilators, companies that supply home ventilators. It's looking at anesthesia machines. So I'm an anesthesiologist when I'm not an ICU doc, and we have these machines in the operating rooms that we can use as ventilators. So we're trying to be as crafty as we can, but there is definitely a mismatch if you look at some of those projections that put the number of ICU cases in the hundreds of thousands.
In that Inquirer article, you talked about a ventilator being almost as complicated as a car. Help us understand, I guess, what makes it so complex.
So I was listening to a podcast the other day that said a ventilator has about 700 parts that all have to be sourced separately. And I think that's probably about right. So at its core, it's really just a bellows that inflates, that gives air to the lungs. And so conceptually, it's very simple. But the thing that makes it so complicated is that the air that we're giving, the breaths, are almost like a prescription. So we have to figure out exactly how big the breaths are, how much pressure to use, how fast to deliver the breath. We have to create an opportunity for the patient's lungs to have some sort of interaction with the ventilator. So the ventilator is detecting what's happening with the patient's lungs, and it can make adjustments in the moment. So all of that is very complicated, and it takes time to create these machines that are able to do that.
I mean, can machines be retrofitted? I you talked to one of our producers, John Aaron, saying that some of the engineers at Penn are at least looking into figuring out how to create ventilators.
Absolutely. There are engineers around the country and around the world. Happy to say that we have some at Penn Engineering as well that are looking at all sorts of ways to create ventilators. They don't necessarily have to be as complicated as the modern ICU ventilator, but they do have to do some basic functions. And so they're working on it. And, you know, I don't know if that will pan out in the time frame that we need it to, but I think we have to fire on all cylinders here. I think we have to look at all possible strategies. And so definitely thinking about what our engineers can do for us is part of that.
You're the director of a new ICU that's going to be built, I guess, at Penn to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. How is that going? And what are you anticipating it will need to have?
So it's an interesting process. The projections that we have are that the number of ICU patients that are going to come in exceed the number of beds that we have. So we have to build new capacity to provide critical care. The unit that I'm helping build, and I'm part of a team, a big team of people that's doing it, is in our post-anesthesia care unit. So basically the idea is normally you would come in for a surgery, have the surgery, you would recover in a place called the PACU or the post-anesthesia care unit. Right. And we have a very capable staff of nurses and docs that take care of our patients in there. We're going to repurpose that and make it into an ICU.
Hold on to that thought only because we're taking a very short break and then we'll get back to
Absolutely.
Our conversation. Hang in there and we'll be right back after this short break. Stay with us. This is
supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Dr. Megan Lane Fall. She's an associate professor of anesthesiology and critical care at the University of Pennsylvania. Director, she was just telling us of a new ICU being built to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. And we're talking about what it's like to treat patients under these conditions. And again, you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. And in about 10 minutes or so, I'll be talking with bioethicist Art Kaplan about some of the challenges of rationing. Are you thinking about rationing, Dr. Lane Fall? Is that a conversation that's being had at Penn?
Well, we're trying to have the conversation in a way that we need to be ready for anything. But the goal right now is to not even get into that situation. So I'm sure Dr. Kaplan will talk with you about some of those considerations. But on my end, it's trying to make sure that we don't get there And so part of it is helping promote social distancing, physical distancing, and decreasing the number of people that need a ventilator at any one time. And we're certainly trying to help people have conversations about whether they would want a ventilator at all. Mm-hmm. There are definitely people who have thought about their own health and have thought to themselves, I would never want to be on a ventilator, but they haven't actually said that to their family, to their loved ones. And so if people could have those conversations, then we could give them the care that they want and hopefully decrease the demand somewhat for ventilators. But we're just hoping not to get there.
Yeah. I mean, those end of life decisions are conversations are so important to have and difficult, I think, for a lot of people. I'm wondering, though, do you have the thinking about just sort of how to manage care, how to decide on care through this pandemic? What kind of guidance you and others who are on the front lines, what you need in terms of what you need to do to take care of some of these really critically ill patients?
I think what we have what we need in the moment. For now, I think that the healthcare system in general is not great at flexing. So we're not great at building capacity very quickly. We're learning how to do that. But that's certainly one of my concerns, is making sure that as we scale up, we're able to maintain the same standard of care and we're able to equip our providers to do what they need to do. Critical care, which is what a lot of these folks need, is not easy. So it's a specialty that our nurses train for years to be able to do. Our docs train respiratory therapists. We have a myriad of people who train to do this. And so trying to upscale the capability for critical care very quickly is difficult. So that's certainly something I think about. And then there are also drug shortages that's making our job harder. Right now it's okay. But I mentioned earlier that these patients need a lot of sedatives. And right. At some point, will run low. We've already started to run low on some of them. So there are some issues like that concern me as I think about the future.
We've heard governors, Cuomo being the most obvious one, but other governors and hospital administrators and even political leaders saying, you know, we need to make sure that we can give hospitals what it is that they need in order to manage this care, but feeling as if they're in competition with each other or in competition even with the federal government, with FEMA. Does that trickle down to you? Do you feel that at all?
A little bit. I certainly have a sense that the efforts to provide personal protective equipment and to provide ventilators are not as coordinated as they could be. And I was talking to a colleague in New York who, you know, obviously is hit very, very hard. And to the point about ventilators, the state of New York has enough ventilators, but it doesn't mean that they're distributed where they need to be. And so there are certain hospitals where in a given moment, you know, they put a breathing tube in and they look around and they go, where's the ventilator? And someone says, oh, well, I don't have one right now. Wow. So that's a problem. And I think we need a somewhat better coordination of these resources across locations.
I mean, so much of our conversation, including the one we're having right now, is about COVID-19, about the coronavirus, but pandemic. But on the other hand, there are people with heart attacks and with cancer and with other, you know, life-threatening illnesses. And I just want to make sure we don't forget them in our conversations.
We absolutely can't. And I'm very worried about the collateral damage, so to speak, for people who have medical conditions that have nothing to do with COVID. So whether it's a person with cancer who can't get their surgery when they need it, if they need surgery, or someone who, as you mentioned, is having a heart attack and the ambulance doesn't get there in time because they're dealing with COVID, I think there's a lot of other ramifications of this that we're just starting to recognize.
And by recognizing, I mean, are there things that can be done in the short term to deal with that, or is it a matter of just being cognizant of the fact that there are so many people, non-COVID people, who need care?
I think it's just having it at front of mind, being cognizant right. that we have to meet the needs of many different types of patients. And what's interesting to me is that certainly we think a lot about people who have COVID right now, but we're also starting to see people who have problems like a heart attack, and they also have COVID because there are so many people that have COVID. So we're seeing these, you know, we see pregnant women with COVID, and I've taken care of a couple of them. So it's not one or the other. Sometimes you've got all of them together.
I began by asking you what it's like, and you said it's chaotic at the ICU, but I'm thinking about, you know, people like yourself and nurses and other doctors who are on the front lines, even people who clean hospitals who are on the front lines of this pandemic, about how you support each other, how, what kind of supports you need from the outside world.
So what we need from the outside world, in part, is for people to stay home so that we have fewer cases to deal with. How we support each other is being patient with each other, taking breaks, showing appreciation. There's been so much food at the hospital.
Really?
I feel very well fed. there are deliveries. We have a special entrance at our hospital just for food, whether people are ordering their food or it's being delivered. But we've had so much generosity from the community. And in one of my other ICUs, we had someone call the hospital and just say, connect me to an ICU. I want to buy them lunch. And so it's been amazing to see the community support.
I mean, things as basic, but also as substantial as lunch can go a long way. You mentioned the fact, and in many ways, what we're doing by staying home is to protect our healthcare system, that it doesn't get overwhelmed with people who come in because they are sick with this coronavirus. And perhaps we should just take a couple of minutes just to remind people about why physical distancing is so important under these circumstances. And I wonder if you could speak to that.
Sure. So the physical distancing speaks to this concept of flattening the curve. And you can sort of imagine, a bell curve where the area under the curve is the number of people that have the disease. What the physical distancing does for us is it doesn't necessarily decrease the area under the curve. It just spreads out the curve so that at any one moment, the number of people that need help are able to be helped by the healthcare system. So right now, we're doing okay in terms of our healthcare system capacity. We have enough ventilators, we have enough ICU beds, we have enough hospital beds. But if people don't stay home and more people get infected quickly, then we will exceed our capacity. And that's where you start to see scenes like New Orleans, where they have the convention center with beds, or New York, where they have the convention center with beds. That's what we're trying to avoid, is just to be able to take care of folks within the current confines of the healthcare system.
Well, we have to end our conversation, and I really appreciate you joining us on Radio Times. I really learned a lot from you, and I appreciate the work that all of you and all the doctors and nurses and medical staff, and as I said, people that are cleaning hospitals on the front lines of this pandemic. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. And that's Dr. Megan Lane Fall. She's an associate professor of anesthesiology and critical care at the University of Pennsylvania. She mentioned director of a new ICU being built to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. Well, we were told to brace ourselves because this week we would see a dramatic increase in the number of deaths and diagnoses associated with COVID-19. Hospitals, as we are learned this morning, are facing an influx of coronavirus patients and in some cases a shortage of life-saving equipment. Johns Hopkins University says there are currently 173,000 ventilators in the United States, not enough to meet the predicted demand. As we heard, doctors and nurses working in hospitals on the front lines of the pandemic are having to do the unthinkable, decide who among their patients is the best candidate for a ventilator because there will not be enough of these life-saving devices to go around. That raises the uncomfortable topic of rationing and how to make ethical decisions in the middle of a public health crisis. And we asked Art Kaplan to join us. Arthur Kaplan, he's a professor of bioethics, founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University School of Medicine, used to be affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania. And Art Kaplan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Do we have Art? All right, we should get him hooked up. Let me just tell our listeners how they can join our conversation, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, again, talking about rationing and trying to figure out the most ethical way to make some of these tough medical decisions. Art, do we have you with us on Radio Times?
Hey, Marty, can you hear me?
I can now. Nice to have you back with us on the show. So much
Thanks
that I wanted.
For having me.
You're very welcome. There's so much I want to talk to you about. But let me just ask you, is it too soon to talk about rationing, which is what I want to talk about? Okay.
No, Dr. Birx, sort of czarina of one of the coronavirus advisory committees for Trump said it was too early, but it isn't too early. And the reason is you have to prepare, you have to debate. And if you're going to have rationing, which I hope we don't, I hope we stave it off, you have to educate everybody about what they're doing, let them emotionally adjust to it. So it's not like you announce tomorrow morning, here's the rationing policy, let's go. Right.
Well, let's talk about what an ethical rationing policy then would look like. How would doctors, people on the front line, how do you decide, you know, who is the best candidate, let's say, for a ventilator if there really is a critical shortage?
All right, I'm going to take you through, if you bear with me, what the rationing really looks like. The first rationing is first responders. If you're really getting an outbreak and a surge, everybody's calling the fire department, the police department, the ambulances all at once. You know, what we don't want to have, the reason we're trying to stay home is that we don't get an acute outbreak and people getting sick simultaneously, and that's what the surge is all about, and that's what would create rationing. So can the ambulance come to your house? How far away do you live? Are you in a rural area? Can you get to the hospital? If you're, say, a 450-pound person living on the fifth floor, and it would take a whole crew 2 hours to get you down, are they going to do that? So that's the first level of where rationing occurs. It's just getting to the hospital. And remember, a lot of our police and fire are out. They're sick. So they're understaffed. So that brings pressure, too. That's one reason, by the way, Marty, if I can say, you don't want to be calling the fire department or the police department unless you really are sick, because you don't want to overwhelm them and you'll see people dying at home without ever getting a chance to get to the hospital.
So that's rationing that's sort of not based on a policy, but just the hard, cold reality of what we're living in.
Correct. And there may be policies, but they're set by the fire department, police, county officials, saying you go first here or you take people there. They probably have department guidelines that I haven't even been privy to about how to handle my 450-pound man situation or someone who's up on a fifth floor with, you know, a lot of medical equipment that they'd have to move at the same time. Right. So I'm not going to say there's no rules. I just don't think those have been as transparent.
I hear you. What about, and I'm thinking just, let's say the first responders get that person, whoever they are, to the hospital. They're in the ICU. We were just talking to an ICU physician, and there are there's one ventilator and two patients in need of that ventilator. How does a doctor decide? Or how should they decide?
The next phase would not be ICU, it's ER. So they're probably going to run in through the emergency room. Now remember, one group of people that does have some training in triage are emergency room docs, because they practice for things like train wrecks and bombings and terrorist attacks and chemical plant explosions where they could get overwhelmed. They are at least somewhat ready to make the decision, because one of the toughest things, Marty, is, am I emotionally prepared to do this? You know, a lot of people in our healthcare system never had to ration anything. You and I know, having talked over the years, by the way, that another area where it's happened is transplant, right?
That's
every
right.
day people die because we don't have enough organs. What do we do there? And I help write those rules, so I have a pretty good idea of what the ER docs are going to be thinking. Use your scarce resource to save the most lives. That's probably what's going to drive it. It's not first come, first serve. It's not random. It's not a lottery. You're going to look at a person and say, you're 75 years old. You have underlying lung disease. You have hypertension. You've had 3 heart attacks. And the other person is 35 years old and doesn't have any obvious medical problems. The likelihood of the older, sicker person not doing as well, that's greater. I'm going to take the younger person. Now, it could flip. I've argued that we shouldn't just use age, because you could have a pretty healthy 65-year-old and a really sick 25-year-old, right? Somebody who vaped and had severe lung damage. They're not going to do well on ventilators. We know that. Right. So that's how they're going to think about it initially. And if they really have a tiebreaker, I'll tell you what they'll probably go to. This is out in a lot of the policies I've seen in the advice that I give. You're probably going to give a little favoritism at that point to healthcare workers, because you need them to get back to work to run the system. And the definition of healthcare worker that I've been advocating for is not just doctors and nurses, but technicians, people who make the food, first responders, people who make the whole system go, people who do the laundry. If you don't have all those people, you don't have a hospital. So I don't think we'll get to tiebreakers very often, but that's one factor that might weigh in.
So is the sort of guiding thinking then who is most likely to survive, who would most benefit from this treatment from a ventilator?
Yes. And by the way, another thing in short supply, just so we all know this, people in severe pneumonia, you know, I'm sure the ICU doc told you about this a little, they also sometimes get into kidney failure, so you're rationing kidney dialysis machines. We have a fair amount of kidney dialysis machines, but what we don't have is a lot of people to run them. So sometimes it's personnel that limits what you can do, not just the machine number.
I was reading about Italy, which, of course, has been in the forefront of this pandemic and having to make some of these really critical decisions. My understanding in Italy is that they did choose younger people, generally speaking, younger people over older people for ventilators. Are you comfortable with that?
No. I heard that they had, in fact, set limits like over 60, you're not going to be considered. I think that's a mistake. My view would be everybody in the lifeboat, regardless of your age, you get considered. Regardless of your disability, you get considered. Regardless of your economic class, I would even argue, even if you're here without papers, without documentation, there are people running around, 19 million of them around the country, those people ought to be considered too. So I think fairness demands that everybody get considered. That is, you all get in the lifeboat, if you will. But then age gets to be a consideration because it is a predictor that you're going to not do well in a ventilator. I've looked up the data. There's a mountain of it. If you're over 75, the chance that you're going to survive a run on a ventilator of 7 days, 10 days, 12 days, which is usually what it takes, is far less than a healthy 30-year-old. But there are very sick children and there are very sick younger people who won't make it at the same rate as someone who's older. And that's why I wouldn't use age just as a blind sorting factor.
Well, hold on to that thought only because we have to take a short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University School of Medicine. We are talking about some of the ethical choices and challenges of rationing care. We're not there yet, but certainly something that we should think about and talk about. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm talking with Arthur Kaplan, Art Kaplan, about some of the ethical questions for healthcare systems, for health providers on the front lines of the pandemic. And again, you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, especially if you've been wrestling with some of these issues. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. One of the things that you have said, Art, I read that if we have a system that is a healthcare system that is transparent, treats all patients fairly, we can talk about whether we have that or not, then there would be more public acceptance for this idea of rationing. I guess, first of all, do we have that kind of a system?
No, absolutely not. In fact, one thing I think is different due to the pandemic is that people who had insurance, who were well off, who were middle class, who had jobs that gave them insurance, even with relatively affordable deductibles, they still seem to me to be shocked at the idea that they could be rationed, whereas we live in a system that has been rationing for decades by ability to pay, by poverty, by if you're homeless, by if you're undocumented. There are plenty of people who don't get care, can't get care, have to do a fundraiser to get an expensive operation because they're not quite poor enough for Medicaid. So now everyone feels the fear that they could be rationed. But it is not a system that has lacked for rationing historically. It's just brought it home. And one other thing, Marty, you know, I've talked about this ability to do well or try to figure out who's going to do better. Well, that penalizes the poor because they've had rotten health care in this country, and they're probably going to be sicker. I see the data coming out of New Orleans with more heavy minority representation. I know where the diabetes and the hypertension and the chronic conditions are. They're in the poorer populations that we've neglected. And so it's a double whammy. It's one I would defend, but it's a double whammy. You got sicker under normal circumstances, and now you're going to get penalized because you won't do as well because of those sicknesses as somebody else.
Well, you know, we know that there are, for some people, great suspicions of our healthcare system. And if we're talking about rationing, a belief that, well, maybe I'll go into the ER, but they're not going to treat me because they don't see me as a valuable person.
Yeah. Well, look, we didn't cure racism in our society. We haven't driven it totally out of medicine either. But I do believe that the message has gone out not to discriminate, and that the policies all say that, and that there would be trouble if someone reported just outright discrimination, either based on gender orientation or race or ethnicity. I'm sure there are plenty of Asian Americans out there, having watched some of the blowback against them, unfair and ridiculous about, you know, being the cause of all this, who are worried, you know, are they going to treat me fairly? But I think the factor that really is going to play a difference here is poverty. I wouldn't worry so much about, you know, am I going to get considered? It's just that the poorer you are, the really likely you are that you're sicker, you have underlying diseases. And I think that is going to penalize minorities unfairly, not due to just plain race prejudice, but due to the, well, yeah, it is race, but it's it's due to the fact
it's
that the country has never solved their health care problems.
You had mentioned...
Can I jump in with one other thing, Marnie?
Go ahead. Sure.
So, you know, we focused in on who's getting the ventilator and who's getting in. But remember, the other way you generate resources is you decide who's going out. And I don't know if you got into this in the prior conversation, but it is just as important to have a policy about who's leaving the ICU because they're not doing well. That's perhaps the most miserable, difficult, awful, emotionally challenging decision of all. You can be generous about who you're trying to let in, you know, sort of saying, well, we'll give them a run on the ventilator, then maybe we can stretch a little bit. There's even some places that are trying to split ventilators between two people that they would try it. If it came to that, well, it's technically very hard to do. But look, if you've been in there 7 days and you don't look like you're doing well, a good ICU person can say, chance of you recovering is not good.
Yeah.
Will we give up faster than normally in order to free up resources? I think you have to be willing to consider that. And you know, we've talked about this too in the past, people have living wills and advance directives, right? They have instructions. If you said, I want everything, I don't think you're going to get honored in the same way as we would in normal times, where we might say, all right, give them another week. If they want to try everything, we'll see if they live a little longer. That's a luxury in rationing you don't have.
You had mentioned organ donation and how scarce organs are given to people in need. Is there something about how we do organ donations now that can help us see our way through this pandemic?
Yeah, I think you can learn from that. The policies for distributing scarce organs have been around for 4 decades. I actually helped contribute to their formulation. We wrote them up because the system was giving too many organs to the rich. There were too many people, Saudi sheiks and potentates from different countries coming into the country in the late 80s and getting livers ahead of Americans. So we came up with a system of rules, and they're the ones that we're talking about. First, consider everybody, don't discriminate. Then try and figure out who's likely to do the best. For transplants, it's your blood type and your immune system, antibodies that match the donor, and a little bit of geography. Can you ship an organ more, is someone closer than far, far, far away? Those sorts of factors. But what I will say is this. If people think the system is fair, that they're considering everyone, you know, not just saying, oh, well, you're disabled, you're not getting a liver, they'll accept the fact that there has to be rationing. If they think the system is not fair, if the disabled, the poor, ethnic minorities are just terrified that they're not going to get fair consideration, then rationing is really hard to do because people just, you know, they're not going to accept it. They protest, they threaten lawsuits and all the rest of it.
I mean, if we had, whether you call it Medicare for all or a public option or some version of just including everyone in on the healthcare system, would it be a more transparent, rational, and ethical system?
Yes, because you're more inclined to support a system if you think that it's being fair to you under ordinary circumstances. If you think the system is overcharging you, which our system does, You think you've been left out because, people are racist and they're not going to help poor people in certain parts of the country. The states have very restrictive eligibility for Medicaid. Then you don't want to support your neighbor. You don't want to help your friend. I know this because organ donation rates are lower in minorities, and I know why. It's because they think they're not going to get a transplant if they need one. So, yes, it can rebound back that way. But if we ever want to take one lesson out of this horror of this plague that besets us, we got to fix the healthcare system once and for all. You cannot have people running around uninsured. I can't believe Trump and the administration is still pressing that lawsuit to get rid of Obamacare. It's still in court. They haven't pulled it.
That's right.
The Medicaid expansions really help in a situation like this in terms of protecting people. So we need that safety net to go out broader.
I wonder, too, and I don't want to be over dramatic talking about rationing, but if we're sort of staring down the barrel of the gun at this, I wonder whether it's also trying to it's taking care of that individual, but also thinking what is for the good of the whole society. And that's a real ethical thicket there to walk through. But I wonder if I'm sure you've thought about that, but sort of how the individual, what the individual deserves and what the whole general society deserves. And if they're not compatible, how do we see our way through that?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, the field I'm in, bioethics, fought for many, many years to try and put patients on a more even footing with their doctors, meaning that they would help, if you will, negotiate how care would go, and they would be more of a partner, not just manipulated by a beneficent doctor, but have more autonomy. And I mean, more informed consent, more choice, more ability to say, this is how I want things to go when I'm dying. When you have a plague, that personalized, individualized medicine goes out the window because now you're trying to use resources for the good of all, not for the good of your patient or for the good of each individual patient. A real revolution in ethical thinking. So when we're talking about these rationing rules, remember I said, hey, we fought for a long time to let you have an advance directive, to let you have a living will, or at least talk to your partner, someone who could speak for you and express your wishes. But when you're really up against resource shortage for life-saving things, that negotiation doesn't happen. Somebody could be, for example, brought to the ICU. They're not going to get the ventilator, and they're automatically, without discussion, not going to be resuscitated because if you're not eligible for a ventilator, there's no point in resuscitating you. Mm. That kind of horrific transition, few of us are used to that kind of thinking, but nonetheless, if I say you can't get a ventilator, you can't get into the ICU, I'm screening you out, you're probably heading directly to palliative care, no discussion.
Right. Let me read a couple of comments. One from Paul. He says, we should plan care based on the fact that life is not fair and never will be. A wealthy person will get better care now and forever. I mean, that's a very pessimistic view, but do you agree with that, Art?
I do. I do think that extreme wealth always advantages people in every society. I don't think there was much doubt that Boris Johnson, when he got sick, the prime minister over in the UK, I don't think he was like sitting at the triage desk in the same way that his citizens might have been. You know, I'm sure they rushed him right into the ICU, no questions asked, began to give him the resources they had. So certain people, the very rich, highly connected politicians, they do better. They do better in every society. I don't like it. I don't think it's fair, but it's probably a reality that's going to be one end of that boundary. I've heard, for example, Marty, that there are people who bought their way to tests, right? They're just private companies, rich people, CEOs who said, well, tests are short, but I have a connection and I can get to this lab and I'll pay cash. And some of them have been tested when that isn't the right thing to do with those tests.
Here are a couple more comments. One from Georgina, who says, my son is a healthcare worker and has to get his own mask. When will we have enough equipment for our healthcare workers on the front line? Such an important question.
Yeah. Again, don't use an N95 mask, even though the recommendation is to start masking at home. All you need is a surgical mask or a bandana. There's instructions online about how to make these things. Mm-hmm. They're to prevent you from giving people disease. But the N95s, help healthcare workers who are in close exposure from picking up the virus from their patients. So that's where they got to be used. We keep hearing from the administration that supplies are on the way, that everything's rosy, there's plenty of this. It's not true. They lie to us. We'll see some finger pointing later about why that happened. But for now, I think we're still about 2 to 3 weeks out from really getting the supply to where it should be. There are definitely big companies like 3M making things, but it takes a while to make them and ship them. So I think we still got a little interlude here where we're pressed on supplies. Again, I haven't really seen horrible rationing yet of ICUs and ventilators, but I know people are reusing equipment, and that's protective gear, and that's not good.
Here's a question from Max. Should we come up with a law that will protect doctors and nurses from lawsuits since they could be forced to make rationing decisions? Such an important question.
Yes, we should. And in fact, New York State has. The legislature has issued immunity for doctors and hospitals who have to make these kind of decisions under dire circumstances. I wouldn't say they've featured it. The governor here hasn't featured it in his press conferences all the time, but it actually was enacted about 4 days ago. And we need that, you know, in all states. That's a state issue to create that kind of immunity.
Right, right. And I'm not all states have been able to figure that out. President Trump has promoted hydroxychloroquine, which apparently is used to treat lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. There are no clinical trials related to COVID-19. But under an emergency, does it make sense to allow people to try things that are unproven?
Well, Dr. Trump got very excited about this particular drug based on a report from France involving, I think, 25 people. It was in a journal. The paper was just retracted as bogus. So he's running off of false information about that particular drug. I have to be very careful when somebody hypes something. Trump and others apparently have stock ownership in some of those companies that make that particular malaria drug. I count 200 plus agents that people want to test and try. Some of them are being pushed by people who own those drugs or have patents on those drugs.
Wow.
So we need studies. Now, if you're desperately ill and dying and someone wants to try something, sure. But here's the difference between what Trump says, which is just give it. Who cares? You don't know the dose. You don't know how often. You don't know how sick the person was when you tried it. You've got to record all that information. Sure. Give things to the dying. Give things to the desperate. Last-ditch efforts, but still do it in an organized, systematic way.
I'm thinking of those coronavirus task force briefings that we are on TV late afternoon, and the president really dominates those hearings. And I want to hear more from Fauci. I want to hear more from Brooks. Yeah. I want to hear more from the people who actually know what is going on and what we're supposed to do.
I agree with that. There's too much of him, not enough of the science and the medicine. You know, Marty, no politician ever defeated a plague. Vaccines do. Medicines do. Behavioral modification based on science does, not rambling around about what do you got to lose, try it.
We're almost out of time here. Speaking of vaccines, we're told maybe a year. What do you think as you look into your crystal ball?
Vaccines are tough. Even if you find one, you know, you try to make maybe 2 billion doses for the world. Yeah. That takes a long time to gear up. I saw Bill Gates has said he's going to start investing in factories because we don't have any to be ready when we get it. It's hard to say. At a minimum, it's 2 years just to find it and distribute it and ship it.
Wow. Well, we have to leave it there on that note. As always, Art Kaplan, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. We got a bunch of them. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.